This is Science Friday. I'm Shayla Farzan, and I'm a science editor with American Public Media.
And I'm SciFri producer Kathleen Davis. We're filling in for Ira this week.
Later this hour, the medical mysteries of mumps and why there are more infections these days, and what happens to the bees, birds, and butterflies when spring springs a little earlier.
But first, if you've been feeling that things are spiraling a bit out of control this week, it may not just be you. This week, astronomers reported that they may have found signs of one of the largest black holes ever detected, a space behemoth the mass of 30 billion suns. Joining me now to talk about that and other science stories of the week is Umair Irfan, science writer at Vox, based in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, Umair.
Hi, Kathleen.
So tell me more about this black hole. 30 billion suns, it really sounds like a lot.
It is. And what's kind of surprising about this, it was actually hard to observe. The thing is, when we observe black holes, usually when they're, you know, millions of light years away, we have to look for signals that they're actually in the process of devouring something, eating a nearby star or a planet. And as they take that matter in and they compress it under that immense gravity, it gives off X-rays and light that we can detect. When black holes are far away from any bits of matter, they're really hard to see because they're not giving off that level of radiation, even if they're huge and massive. And so what scientists used here was a technique called gravitational lensing. And rather than looking for the black hole itself, they looked for signs that light was bending around this black hole. Scientists started observing this kind of pattern here around this particular black hole around 2004, and only recently did the advances in observation and supercomputing technology catch up for them to actually calculate and determine that something was there.
So this sounds really interesting, but does this get us anything beyond, you know, just another addition to the list of really big black holes?
Well, it shows us what's possible. Just seeing something this massive that could still be hidden from our sight shows that we need to look for these kinds of things in other places. And we have a better understanding of just how to find perhaps other ultra massive black holes that may be lurking out there.
So let's stay in space for a moment. A few weeks ago, we talked about the fact that a leaking Soyuz craft might mean that astronauts on board the International Space Station might have to stay up there for longer. That leaky capsule returned to Earth empty this week. Tell me what's going on there.
Yeah, that's right. American astronaut Frank Rubio was supposed to return home and instead is going to be staying until September, and that will likely make him the American with the longest stay in space. But that's going to have some interesting effects for science because now scientists can study effects of space over long periods of time. And one thing that they're starting to study more is aging.
That brings us to our next story, which isn't about Frank Rubio specifically, but yes, is about aging. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Right. I read this article in Inverse by John Kelvey, and it looks at this new study that examines biomarkers for aging in space. Basically, scientists have found that when astronauts come back from space, they have all these aging-related biomarkers that seem to indicate that they're aging prematurely, but they weren't quite sure of what the mechanism was. And so this team of researchers, they started studying this protein called SUMO, which stands for small ubiquitin-like modifier. And they found that under normal gravity conditions, SUMO is known to respond to stress and play roles in repairing DNA. But in microgravity, when they engineered yeast to produce this protein, they found that it actually increased the abundance of certain kinds of protein by more than 50% compared to normal gravity. And they're not quite sure exactly what this is doing, but it helps put a link in the chain of what is causing this sort of premature aging signs here.
So this isn't quite like the movie Interstellar, but it may bring us a little bit closer to understanding aging.
A little bit. You know, in Interstellar, the whole thing there was about relativity, that when you're moving really fast in space, time effectively for you moves slower than it does for people on Earth. And it seems like, well, that dividend with aging may be counteracted in other ways. The microgravity could be accelerating the aging on your body, and that may not necessarily end up helping you over the long term.
Okay, let's go back down to Earth. For health news of a different kind, the FDA gave approval for the drug Narcan to be sold over the counter. First, Umair, give us a quick rundown of what Narcan is and tell me why this is such a big deal.
Right. Narcan is a drug that reverses opioid overdoses. It's administered as an injectable or as a nasal spray, and it's fairly simple to use and it's fairly effective. And it's just in time because in the U.S., opioids have killed about 80,000 people per year in recent years, and we've seen a spike in deaths related to fentanyl, another opioid that's been spreading throughout different parts of the U.S. as well. And this seems to be a very critical backstop to be able to prevent some of the worst effects of opioid overdoses.
It sounds to me like making this over-the-counter is an undeniable win.
It is, but it doesn't solve the entire problem, because while it is over the counter, insurance companies may not necessarily pay for it. And, you know, right now it costs about $38 per dose out of pocket, and that could deter people from buying it or keeping it on hand in case of emergencies. And then there's also fears that it can create a moral hazard, that it might encourage more reckless behavior if this is more widely available. But health officials and public health researchers say that it's actually a good idea to have more of these around to prevent deaths. And the company that makes them says that they'll have more of them available on store shelves and even available to buy online later this summer.
So next up, you have a story about electric vehicles and the challenges that come with charging them when you're on the go.
Yeah, I talked to a couple electric vehicle owners about some problems they've had at these charging stations, specifically when it comes to superchargers. These are the charging stations that can deliver lots of power to a battery and charge you up in just a few minutes rather than the hours it typically takes when you use a wall outlet. The problem is, though, if something goes wrong, it can go really wrong. And the people that I talked to had their cars bricked. Essentially, they wouldn't work anymore. And in one case, the plug actually ended up welding to the car and they had to pry it out with a crowbar. And the reason this is important is that, you know, EVs are now more popular than ever. Their ranges are longer than ever, and people are starting to make road trips. But the infrastructure hasn't quite caught up, and it's not as reliable as it could be. And that might be deterring the adoption of EVs in the U.S.
So what's the solution here? I mean, other than keeping these chargers in order?
Well, there are a few. One is that the government could potentially enforce uniform standards across EV chargers and car makers so that the chargers and cars aren't all speaking different languages. They stick to a consistent protocol and a standard, and that makes it a little bit easier and leaves less room for things to go wrong. There are also some EV charging companies that are developing chargers that have more fail-safes built in. Tesla said earlier this year that it's going to be opening its supercharger network to other automakers as well, and so that'll help bolster the number of EV charging stations that are out there. And I talked to a couple companies that are building, you know, batteries into the EV chargers so that they don't need to draw as much power from the grid, which means that they can deploy more quickly and with fewer permits and help get through some of the red tape that's holding them back right now.
So let's move on to a story that certainly put a smile on my face. I hope it did the same for you, Umair. There's a new study out that shows that some dinosaurs had lips. Can you tell me about this?
Yeah, that's right. You know, when you imagine a Tyrannosaurus Rex or what you've seen in the movies, you see this sort of snaggle-toothed dinosaur with teeth sticking out. Well, this team of researchers says that's probably the wrong image, that dinosaurs, like a lot of modern lizards, probably had lips that covered their teeth. What they did was that they looked at this dinosaur called Despletosaurus, which is a relative of the T-Rex, and they hypothesized that if the teeth were exposed to air, that would dry out those teeth and make the enamel on them brittle and prone to splitting and cracking. And so they looked for signs of that on these dinosaur teeth. And they found that they actually looked like that they were very well protected. And that pointed them toward the direction that perhaps that there was a covering over them, maybe a set of lips. Then they also looked at modern lizards like Komodo dragons and monitor lizards and looked at how their teeth responded to having lips around them and said that they had a lot in common with these fossilized teeth, pointing them in the direction that perhaps there were some lips covering these dinosaurs. So they weren't always bearing their fangs. But some scientists disagree, saying that the researchers didn't account for changes in bone texture and differences between modern lizards and dinosaurs. But this is an intriguing finding because soft tissue is not something that's fossilized. And so we have to use a lot of our imaginations to fill in the blanks.
And just to be clear, I shouldn't be imagining some, you know, big juicy red lips on a T-Rex.
No, these dinosaurs were not getting filler. They were not, you know, using Instagram filters. They still looked like dinosaurs. They still looked kind of mean and scary, but not with those sharp teeth sticking out.
Well, speaking of pointy things, you have a story about a biotech advance that uses bacteria as a syringe. Can you tell me about this?
Right. There's been a lot of work recently about using microorganisms as tools, like using virus phages to attack bacteria or using good bacteria to treat illnesses. Well, one team of researchers, they found out that they could actually harness this particular feature of this bacterium called Photohabdus. And what they found is that by engineering it, what it would do is that it would actually insert a tube into targeted cells and inject something. And what the scientists say is that effectively this becomes sort of a syringe that can be used to inject medicine, protein, and even mRNA or other kinds of, you know, gene editing tools to help deliver medicine or cause other kinds of modifications in a very targeted way.
So we have time for one more quick story, and it's getting a little bit warmer outside. So if people are considering an early spring cookout, there's some food news this week involving a mammoth meatball. Can you tell me about this?
There's this company in Australia called Vow, and they announced this week that they have successfully grown woolly mammoth tissue, and they turned it into a meatball. Which seems like an odd thing to do when you've been able to engineer and grow an extinct animal. But they wanted to do this as sort of a proof of concept. They were able to isolate the mammoth myoglobin gene, which gives meat its red distinctive taste and color. And they were able to also fill in the blanks using African elephant DNA. And they were able to grow this in a laboratory and grow enough of it that they could actually make, you know, a physical solid object out of this. Now, I don't think anybody is going to be eating this anytime soon, and it's not clear exactly what direction they want to go in this, but lab-grown meat is proposed as one of the solutions to help deal with warming and some of the impacts of agriculture on the environment. You know, about 40% of the world's methane comes from livestock production, but it's also sort of a dicey area ethically, and also regulators are still trying to figure out what they can do with this. Singapore right now is the only country in the world where you can actually get, you know, a mammoth meatball sub, or rather a lab-grown meat. But the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is evaluating this as well. So you may not be able to buy a mammoth sandwich, but perhaps something else that was grown in a lab could be on your plate sometime soon.
Well, considering that I am not a billionaire, I probably will not be able to sink my teeth into a mammoth meatball, but I can only imagine that it tastes, I don't even know what it would taste like.
If you were given the opportunity, would you take one? Would you try one?
You know what? I would maybe take a bite, and then I'd probably feel very ethically conflicted about it later. That's all the time that we have for now. I'd like to thank my guest, Umair Irfan, science writer at Vox, based in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.